You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Carl Elliott. He is a professor at the Center for Bioethics at the University of Minnesota. His work has appeared in The New Yorker quite recently, The Atlantic Monthly, The Believer, and on Slate.com. He's the author or editor of six previous books, including Better Than Well, Prozac as a Way of Life, The Last Physician, and A Philosophical Disease. Elliott lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's here to talk about his new book, White Coat, Black Hat. Please join me in welcoming Carl Elliott.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. My brother has been encouraging people to turn up at this talk and shout "You lie" throughout it. We're from South Carolina, so if that feel free to do that. That would just make me feel, at home. No, I like it really. So I thought I'd talk for about, 15 minutes or so about the book, and then we can I'll answer questions. So if this book were a sermon, and it does have sermon-like qualities, I have to admit, it would start with a parable, and this particular parable has the additional virtue of being true. It's how I start the book, and I thought I would just tell it to you here. This is actually a story from my brother Hal, my other brother, who is a psychiatrist in North Carolina and who trained at the University of North Carolina back in the late 80s and early 90s. And when he was a first-year resident at Chapel Hill, one of his fellow residents was a Harvard graduate by the name of Lee Shumate. That's actually his real name. I gave him a fake name in the book just to avoid liability issues. And he wasn't actually just a Harvard Medical School graduate. He also had a PhD in neuroscience from Harvard. And he'd come down to Chapel Hill as a medical student the year before to do a fourth-year elective. And when he was there, he had gotten engaged to a psychiatry resident in the class ahead of him. And the two of them had gotten married the summer before, and they were looking for some way to train in the same city, and Chapel Hill seemed like the perfect place. Something a little off about Shumate, though, something a little odd. It wasn't so much that he was a terrible resident. It was that he didn't really pull his weight on the wards in the hospital. He was always trying to weasel his way out of call, always trying to get out of work. And he had this sort of obsequious way about him, and obsequious in a way that was hard to figure out. So it wasn't just that he tried to ingratiate himself with senior faculty members. So he wasn't always just sucking up to the attendings, which is normal. I mean, that's what you do when you're a resident. But he also was trying to ingratiate himself with the other residents, which was odd. And I can remember Hal saying, I was always asking myself, why is this guy sucking up to me? I mean, what does he think I can do for him? So that was one odd thing. The other odd thing was a thing about women. And in particular, he really liked them. So just a few weeks after he arrived, and remember, arrived married to one of the residents, started having an affair with a second resident. And then fairly soon after starting the affair with the second resident, there was a rumor that he had started a third affair with the hospital attorney, which is not really the ideal way to get started in medicine. And so that happened all throughout the first year. And at the very end of the first year, all the new residents are required to take board exams, licensing exams. And so everybody had to register with the State Board of Medical Examiners. So the State Board goes to the AMA to verify Shumate's credentials. and they get a strange response. AMA says, we don't have a file on this guy. So then they call up Harvard. Harvard says, we don't have a file on this guy either. So then the training director at Chapel Hill calls him into his office and said, Lee, you know, there seems to be kind of a problem with your file here. And Shoemate says, I'm going to have to talk to my lawyer. And then he disappeared. And nobody has heard from him since that day. So it turned out that he was a fraud. He hadn't gone to Harvard, hadn't gone to medical school. He didn't have a PhD in neuroscience. Hadn't even gone to college. Everything was a forgery. He had forged degrees. He had forged letters of recommendation. He faked everything. There was later a rumor that he may, at one point in his life, have worked as a technician at a hospital in Texas somewhere, which may have been why he was able to, you know, fake his way around the hospital. But as far as anybody could officially determine, he'd practiced psychiatry for 14 months with essentially no medical training whatsoever. So why do I start the book with that parable? What's the lesson here? Well, there are actually two things that I think are important. One is about the, you know, the psychological difficulty that most people have with outing the bad guys, even when everybody knows that they're the bad guys and need to be outed. Most of us just don't like to do that, or at least not publicly. And, you know, it's uncomfortable, it's anxiety-producing, and most of us just look for any reason not to do that, to avoid the problem, because it's just a lot easier to look the other way. And that's sort of what happened with Shoemate. A lot of what he was doing, like all the fooling around on his wife, which everybody knew about, that wasn't a secret. And then after he left, it became pretty clear that he'd done a lot of other stuff as well, which was much worse. So, for example, there was a patient who came forward and said that he had sexually assaulted her in therapy. It also turned out that he had testified as a psychiatrist in a murder trial, and the murder trial had to be thrown out. Then it came out that he had misdiagnosed a woman. He had diagnosed her as having ulcerative colitis. She'd actually had ulcerative colitis. He had diagnosed her as having depression, said that she was a danger to herself, and had her involuntarily committed. So not exactly a benign presence in the medical school, but for whatever reason, when he was there in Chapel Hill, nobody confronted him. Nobody reported him, and nobody suspected that he was a fake. I can remember talking to Hal, my brother. We kind of became obsessed with this case over the years, so we talk about this a lot. And he says, you know, as a resident, I thought, this guy is really bad. You know, I thought he was just a really bad doctor. And I kind of thought, you know, Harvard. I thought Harvard was better than this. But I never really thought that he wasn't a doctor at all. That thought never occurred to him. So that's one thing, you know, that I think is interesting about the story. The other lesson that I draw from it is about deception. Now, medicine is kind of a unique institution in that it mainly works on a kind of honor system. It's self-policed. It's largely self-regulated. Which means that it's very easy for people with bad motives to exploit. So for me, that's sort of the bigger theme with the book, which is, you know, what happens when you take an honor-based profession and then you invite in all these businesses with a financial interest in exploiting that system? The pharmaceutical industry, the clinical trials industry, the PR industry, the CME industry, the research ethics industry. Well, what happens is a lot of deception, a lot of fakery, a lot of fraud, a lot of cheating, which also means for me, lots of great material. And so, here's another example. And this one from right here at the U. We don't need to go to the south for all our examples here. So here's a, this one, this is a story. This started about 10 or 12 years ago. My office in the Bioethics Center is over in Boynton. And I'm in my office and I get a phone call. It's a psychiatrist by the name of Farouk Abuzahab. I don't know if that name rings any bells in here. Didn't ring any bells for me. I was new. He tells me he wants to sit in on an ethics class that I'm teaching. Says there's been some trouble with a research study that I've done. He's being told that he's got to take a class in medical ethics. That's why he's calling me. I've never gotten a call like this before. I'm not that happy about my class as an instrument of punishment for this guy. Although there's probably some justification for that perception, but, I thought, why not? What's the harm? And so I told him he could sit in. He told me he used to be on the faculty here. He told me that he used to be chairman of the the Minnesota Psychiatric Society Ethics Committee. And he seemed like a relatively nice guy. And so I let him sit in, and it went fine. I didn't give a lot more thought to the guy until a few years ago when a new for-profit clinical trial site across over in St. Paul opened up called PRISM Research. Does this ring any bells for people? You always see PRISM Research ads in the back of city pages advertising for volunteers. So it opened up. I started looking around at their website, and I saw that Abuzahab was one of their researchers. And I thought, hey, that's funny. That's that same guy that was in my ethics class. And I started to wonder, what exactly was the incident that brought him to that class? Well, it's kind of embarrassing to say this now, but it turned out that his medical license had been suspended for 2 years. And the reason it was suspended was that he was responsible for the deaths and injuries of 46 people under his care. Quite a few of them had committed suicide. 17 had been research studies in research subjects in studies that he was doing for the pharmaceutical industry. And these were basically studies where he had taken patients who were severely mentally ill and then cycled them in and out of studies of new psychiatric drugs, even if they didn't meet eligibility criteria for the studies, and then kept them in the studies even after they got worse. And sometimes he kept them in until they committed suicide, like one woman who walked out of Fairview Hospital and threw herself into the Mississippi River. Now, for me, there's kind of a sense in which Abuzahab is emblematic of something about our new medical economy. Which is to say, he's a clinical investigator, he's a researcher, but he's not an academic. He's not designing trials, he's not publishing trials, he's not getting tenure or prizes or academic fame. What he is getting is a lot of money. And he's getting more money, in fact, for putting patients in trials than he would get for treating them outside the study. Now, I think most of us would just assume, if we were asked to sign up for a research study, that there is somebody out there, somebody watching to make sure that the guy in charge of our trial is not a guy like Dr. Abuzahab. But we would be wrong, because there is no such oversight. There's very little oversight. Now, it's not that his disciplinary file is hard to find. It's a public document. You can just go to the website and download it. His problems are not secret. First Google hit you get on him is a long article in Boston Globe about a suicide in a clinical trial that he did. Yet, despite those 46 deaths and injuries, despite winding up on the front page of the New York Times, despite my writing about him in the New Yorker, he still worked as a speaker or a consultant for a dozen different drug companies. He still continued to do trials. He was awarded a Distinguished Life Fellowship by the American Psychiatric Association. In fact, just before I came over to give this talk, I ran another search, found out that he's still working for Eli Lilly and Pfizer, and he's still an adjunct professor in our Department of Psychiatry here. Now, that said, that's scary. Most of the stories in the book are actually not like that at all, by which I mean they're not my stories told from the outside. In the book, I'm actually a lot more interested in the insiders. So my favorite people in the book are actually the professional guinea pigs. These are people who make their living by testing new drugs for money. So, you know, if you know those signs that are all over in the medical school and the hospital advertising for volunteers for research studies, these guys do that for a living. Just go from one study after another testing the safety of new drugs for money. And so I want to know, what is that like? You know, what is the life of a guinea pig pro actually like? How do they figure out which studies are safe? You know, how do they figure out which places are dangerous and that they should avoid? What's it like to spend 3 weeks with a bunch of strangers in a suburban drug testing site wearing an IV and a rectal probe for money and have that be your job? And in a way, the same thing goes for the other people that I talk about in the book, the medical ghostwriters, the drug reps, the academic thought leaders, the various PR professionals. Because the more I listen to these people's stories, the more devious I find their scams, and the more devious the scam, the more fascinated I get. And so it's a little bit like listening to you know, a crooked dealer in a Vegas casino explain that the tables are rigged so that the house always wins. And, you know, you're sort of a little shocked at first, but then once that wears off, your natural question is, you know, how'd you do it? And that, you know, in a way is what the book is about. What's the scam and how do they do it? And I think I'm glad to tell you more about the book, but I think, you know, sort of that's a fairly decent overview of what it's about. So I think I'll stop there and just take any questions that you have.
Do you have any suggestions in your book for what the public can do in response to this?
Nope. You can pray, say a few. No, I'm just, you know, here's the thing. So I think that a lot of people have the idea that, or wish that it were true, that there were a sort of mechanism for purpose, for individual self-protection, right? That, you know, I, for example, that I can somehow give them advice on how to spot a ghostwritten journal article, or how to spot a crooked clinical investigator, or how to spot a rigged clinical trial, or any of these things. And, you know, the fact is, the people who are designing these things to try to beat the system are extremely sophisticated, and the whole point is to make the, you know, make the deception difficult to spot. And, you know, there are certain things that I could say. I mean, I could say, you know, I think that the Cochrane Collaboration and the Medical Letter are better places to look for medical information than most medical journals, you know, for example. But in general, I think the problems are such that they're going to take some sort of collaborative, systematic fix. There's not so much that people can do individually to, you know, to protect themselves. It's going to take a lot of people joining up to see how, you know, to make the fixes in the system so that we can be protected. From a regulatory standpoint, but also just the entire way that the whole system is set up. There's got to be a different set of regulations. There's got to be a different funding model. There's a whole kind of range of things that have to be done to fix it.
My question is about, where do you think these people are falling through the cracks? I mean, I'm speaking as far as, like, physicians, that are doing these corrupt things. Do you think it's something that they're missing in medical school and residency screening processes, like people are corrupt from the very get-go, or do you think it's something kind of inborn to the process of becoming a physician, whereas, you know, you're working hard as a resident and you're maybe in family medicine, you're not making as much as like an anesthesiologist or radiologist, this is an easy way to make a couple bucks, you know? I mean, do you think it's part of the structural medical issues that we're dealing with, just in like compensating our physicians, or do you think it's just more of like an innate person, this person is corrupt and they're gonna do it no matter what the system is? I would just hate to, it's hard for me to think of like my classmates, my future classmates doing something like, you know, allowing these people to commit. So, you know, it just seems so beyond what you would think a person who wanted to go into medicine would do.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's the case. In fact, a lot of the people that I talk about, you know, probably the vast majority of people in the book are not doctors, they're businessmen. I think the overarching problem is the system of financial incentives and the lack of oversight. Medicine, I mean, because of the fact that medicine has this long history as a kind of honor system that's self-policed and largely, you know, very loosely regulated, it's very easy to exploit. So when you come in and, you know, for example, I mean, just to take doctors, for instance, there are just not the same kind of conflict of interest rules for doctors that there are for other professions. So, for example, if you're a journalist writing about the pharmaceutical industry for the New York Times, it would be unthinkable for you to be allowed to take $500,000 from a pharmaceutical company that you're covering. But it's fine for a doctor to do that, and it's fine for an ethicist to do that. I mean, there are a lot of bioethicists consulting for the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, despite the fact, so if I were a journalist writing about Eli Lilly, it would be improper and banned for me to take money from Eli Lilly. But if I'm a bioethicist writing about Eli Lilly or a doctor writing about Eli Lilly, it's fine. For some reason, we don't have the same conflict of interest rules for doctors that we have for journalists or policemen or judges or, you know, a whole range of other professions. And, you know, that would be easily fixable. I mean, I think you can go through each of the other things that I talk about in the book, you know, the public relations industry, the medical ghostwriters, and so on, and you see that same profit motive at work.
The honor system?
No, that's the reason the honor system. I mean, that's the, you know, once you introduce, once you say, we're not going to have any policing here, but then you introduce the financial incentives to game the system. I mean, financial incentives plus lack of policing equals a lot of dishonesty.
And the lack of policing is an aspect of the honor system.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
What percentage are you seeing the FDA as being buried in this morass? Are they somehow left on the sidelines, or are they actively looking at it and turning away? Where do they fit?
I think part of the problem, you know, the financial problem is also the problem with the FDA, because in the early 90s, we made the decision in order to speed up drug approval that we would allow the pharmaceutical industry to fund the FDA. And so when you're allowing the industry to fund the agency that's regulating it, I mean, that's a problem. That said, I do think that a larger part of the problem with the FDA is that, you know, they're well-intentioned people who were just overmatched by the job that they're asked to do, because they're really the final word on so many things, and so many people want them to regulate all these different things. Like, why doesn't the FDA get interested in ghostwritten journal articles? Or, you know, why does the FDA pay so little attention to direct-to-consumer advertising? And why is the FDA not interested in funding of patient advocacy groups and all these other things? Well, you know, the FDA can only do so much, and, you know, they just don't have the resources to do all the things that need to be done as far as regulation goes. That's my feeling, anyway.
Just secondary, the corporate is funding the FDA? How is that? What percentage of funds do those comprise versus tax or the governmental?
You know, I wish I could tell you. I don't know. It's called user fees, and the basic idea in the early 90s was that drug approvals were too slow, and the FDA was too cumbersome. And so the idea was, if pharmaceutical companies want to fast track their drugs, they can pay this user fee and get it done faster. And those user fees were supposedly used to beef up the industry, let them hire more people, and which would lead to faster approvals. And it did, but it also led to a kind of capture of the agency by the pharmaceutical industry. You had a question.
Well, I was going to say, when I've seen talks by doctors, they often have to preface it by saying whether or not they were sponsored by somebody. And I'm not sure who's enforcing that or if that's just their own ethics bringing that up. I would think they're doing that because somebody requires them.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty standard, and it's becoming more of the preferred solution for conflict of interest. My question is, well, what do you do with that information once you find out that they're getting paid from, 20 different pharmaceutical companies? I mean, do you just leave at that point, or, I'm just not sure what disclosure, I mean, how it really helps.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised by the lack of outrage, given sort of some of the stories that have come out in your book. And, for instance, the New York Times review of your book seemed sort of flat, I thought. So I'm just, I guess, curious if bioethicists, people of you, and your peers of yours, if you've established some kind of activist group that's actively, perhaps, lobbying Congress or doing something that's bigger than just you.
No. there are activists, and it's a very committed sort of close-knit group, a lot of people who work together, but most of them are not in bioethics. Bioethicists, I think, have sort of fallen prey to the same thing that the medical profession has, which is too many ethicists working for the pharmaceutical industry. There are glimmers of hope out there, actually. I mean, the American Medical Student Association has actually been extremely good as far as I know, just about the only sort of organized medical body that's actively working against pharmaceutical industry influence in medicine. And there are a handful of, old people from the 60s who are still, plugging away, but mostly not ethicists.
In theory, there should be adequate oversight from the state boards of medical practice or academic institutions and so on. Are you suggesting that there should be some other source of oversight?
The oversight from those bodies has to be a lot better. Minnesota consistently ranks last in the country as far as the number of doctors disciplined by the state licensing board. South Carolina is usually next to last. but Minnesota is usually last. So there's probably no state that has a really stellar reputation as far as this goes. But, it's not just the licensing boards. I mean, there's a huge problem, I think, with oversight of clinical trials, which is, largely done by institutional review boards, which are either, colleagues of the researchers in places like this. And so, I was on the IRB here for years, and you're being asked to evaluate the research protocols of people that that you work with. Sometimes they may be your department chair or someone who has control over your career in some way, which is clearly not, a sufficient regulatory arm. Or what's happened now is the whole business of for-profit IRBs, for-profit research ethics boards, where pharmaceutical companies simply pay a research ethics board to approve their study, which seems, you know, completely crazy to me. And, you know, with each piece of this, journal articles, research oversight, doctors, and so on, there's a body that could be doing a better job than it's actually doing.
Are you suggesting a new body?
Well, you know, in most for research ethics, for example, most countries don't have a for-profit research ethics oversight system. I mean, as far as I can tell, it's only us and the Canadians who allow that. And most, you know, European countries organize it in a system of regional ethics committees, which are neither for-profit nor subject to the kind of regulatory capture that goes on in universities. And that seems like a better solution to me.
I was going to say, as a society, shouldn't we just, you know, from birth on, it seems like pop the pill for everything. You know, your kid's too active, give them a pill. Maybe we have to re-educate people not to take drugs all the time.
Well, I mean, the problem is knowing which drugs to take. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, because the fact is some drugs are good and some, you know, some illnesses are really bad and they're extremely bad to get if you don't have any drugs for them. So, you know, the difficulty, I mean, I wouldn't want to become totally nihilistic about the, you know, the system and say, you know, no drugs. But, you know, the difficulty now is that, you know, so many sources of authority about which drugs are good and which drugs are bad have been undermined that it's very difficult to make, you know, a reasoned decision about, you know, what to take.
So hearing, like, some proposals you might have is one thing, but what do you think the next change might be if you had to actually guess, put your money on? Is there going to be regulation sometimes?
If I had, you know, I had to bet that there would be a change, my bet would be no change. That would be my bet. The only thing here's, all right. So maybe I do have a bet. It seems like a lot of what we've found out over the last 10 years about pharmaceutical industry wrongdoing, and clinical trials wrongdoing, and so on, has come from litigation. And so what happens is, turns out a drug has, you know, proven to be dangerous, like Vioxx, for example. People are getting injured. There's a lawsuit. And then the lawyers or the expert witnesses or somebody makes the internal documents public. And it turns out that the company, Merck, in that case, has known about the dangers for years and tried to cover it up. And so, you know, when there's one lawsuit like that, and that happens, there's a lot of encouragement, you know, to do it again with the next one. And so what we've seen are just a series of these cases, one after the other, and there's a pattern. And the pattern is, you know, the same one that you saw with Vioxx, which is they knew about it, and they're trying to spin studies or manipulate studies in order to make their drug look better and to stay on the market as long as possible. So the penalties for that have gradually been getting higher. They're still nothing compared to the profits. I mean, tiny. You're talking, you know, even the largest so far has been $2.2 billion against Pfizer. But when you're talking about drugs that are worth $10 billion a year, that's really very small. Now, that said, it's possible, you know, if there were enterprising and ingenious trial lawyers, they could find their way into other aspects of the system. So, for example, clinical trial injuries, that's largely an unexplored area of litigation. So most of the litigation has been about fraudulent marketing and anti-kickback suits. But if lawyers were to catch on to the fact that, you know, there are people who've been hurt or killed in these rigged research studies, they might start going after those as well. So if I had to make a bet, I would think, you know, that might be one possibility. I wouldn't bet on more regulation, not until there's a huge sort of incident on the level of, you know, the financial crisis or the Gulf oil spill to promote, you know, enough public outrage so that there's a call for more regulation.
I read an article going off of the two previous questions. I read an article last year that the part of the reason the swine flu was sort of overplayed or hyped up was because European pharmaceutical companies had a huge role in, you know, hyping it up so that they could sell their vaccines. So I was wondering what, you know, if you know about that or what your stance is, you know, on vaccines and the regulation of that.
I don't, you know, I've heard that, I've read those same stories as well, but I don't know enough about them to, you know, to comment. There was a very interesting group of PR people in the book that I talked to, whose job is essentially to do that. I guess I heard some vaccine stories, but in general, so the idea is, you're working with media. For example, there's this one guy that I talked to, Michael Friedman, and his job has been to produce something called video news releases. And this is essentially fake news. It appears on the news, but it's actually sponsored by a corporation or a governmental entity or something like this. So you think that you're hearing a story about, a dangerous asthma, you know, conditions for asthma in the inner city, but in fact, it's been paid for by Merck, which makes an asthma drug. And it's very, really very difficult to spot those things. And if you talk to him, he was saying, you know, you're always looking for a hook for these things. You know, you're always looking for a hook in order to promote awareness of a disease, to make people think that it's worse than it is. So, you know, there are all the months, you know, prostate cancer awareness month or bladder control awareness day or, you know, whatever. And you can turn that into a news story on the news. I think those have, at least he tells me, those video news releases have largely gone away. But he's got all these other scams in place to replace them.
I would have originally had a lot of faith in IRBs, and I guess I'm not clear, be they institutional review boards. You were saying Abuzahab works through some privates? Like, I'm not sure about these private clinical trials. I thought pretty much clinical trials were through institutions, which would have a fair bit of ethics behind them.
That was the old days. That's the old days. No. Okay. So what happened, starting in the early 90s, this is sort of in the blockbuster, the dawn of the blockbuster drug model. Pharmaceutical companies started to get frustrated with how slow universities were, how slow university IRBs were, and how slow university investigators were at recruiting subjects. So they decided, we could do this a lot better privately. And so there emerged the contract research industry, companies like Quintiles and PPD, Covance, Parexel, a whole bunch of them. And their job is mainly just the clinical trials business, that you can outsource everything to these people. So over the past 20 years, there's been this massive outflow of money from from academic health centers to the private sector. But then the question is, well, who's in charge of the ethics of those? And well, there's a new market for that. And so you started to see these new for-profit research ethics boards or IRBs come up as well. The big one that I talk about more in the book, it's kind of a huge mega complex in Olympia, Washington, is a place called Western IRB. And they approve a tremendous number of clinical trials. And it's totally for profit. You know, if you find a, if a drug company or a CRO is trying to get ethics approval from a trial and one for-profit IRB turns it down, they just go to another one. If they turn it down, they go to another one. And you can see where the incentives are there. You don't want to be the kind of IRB that turns down a lot of trials and sends people to others. You want to keep them coming back to you. Now, you know, that said, I can't say that I think university IRBs are a whole lot better, because university IRBs are competing with the for-profit IRBs for business. Because this is, you know, this is the way it works now. And if the University of Minnesota wants to keep trials, if they want to keep pharmaceutical companies from going to the private sector, they basically have to compete in the same marketplace against them. Our IRB charges the pharmaceutical industry to for trials now. I think it's $2,500 a trial. Do you have something, Lee?
Well, the Imuzahab story is interesting. I mean, both the specifics of the story, but also, I mean, you mentioned how it ends with him still having adjunct status here at the university and still working for the industry. And I guess, I mean, I think part of the investigative process is you think the act of unmasking, unraveling, bringing to public light is supposed to have some kind of purpose. And I'm just wondering, I mean, if someone manages to attract the attention of the Boston Globe and the front page of the New York Times and appears in your New Yorker piece and is in your book, I mean, how does someone survive that degree of scrutiny and remain as an adjunct faculty member here at the university and also continue to, I gather, play a role in running clinical trials, or at least...
You know, who's to stop them? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I can remember...
What's in it for this university? I mean, a tenured faculty member, there's a process you have to go through to get rid of the person. Why would someone in his position, why would he still have that connection with this institution?
He must make money for you.
I don't know. You know,
maybe they're big enough to shut up.
In the case of he's got an adjunct appointment, so he's not really making money anymore. I just don't even know why they would want anything to do with him. But I can remember, you know, it just sort of stunned me when I was working, I was looking into his case that, you know, that the FDA hadn't done something, because he'd never appeared on the list of sanctioned investigators from the FDA, even though his license had been taken away for 2 years and, you know, 46 deaths and injuries. And when I talked to a guy at the FDA, he just said, you know, first thing, FDA inspects 1% of clinical trial sites. So 99% go uninspected. That's just, you know, that's how the business works. And he says, what we have to concentrate on are the places where they're doing trials with hundreds and thousands of patients, you know, huge places doing lots of clinical trials. If he's a guy who's doing, you know, a trial where he's just recruiting 6-8 patients at a time, you know, he's never going to come on up on our radar screen. He'll never be, you know, the kind of subject that we would inspect. And, you know, I was puzzled because, you know, I thought, like, shouldn't the state licensing board, like, notify the FDA? I mean, but, you know, when I talked to them, I got the impression they didn't even really quite understand what a clinical trial was. I mean, when I suggested, you know, shouldn't you be getting in touch with the research oversight people, you know, just like, what, you know? There was just really no, you know, no sense that was part of their job at all. And that's, you know, I think that's largely what goes on, is like nobody sees that it's their job. Everybody just assumes, well, there's somebody watching these people, right? But there's not anybody watching.
There's a movement afoot worldwide, in a sense, to regulate complementary therapies and drugs. Australia is one to have banned a lot of the complementary stuff, but Britain has it on the docket. We're looking at it now. Do you see this as kind of a collusion with the FDA corporate to take over that?
I don't know. That's something that I really haven't looked into a whole lot. I mean, my sense is that, that piece is largely unregulated in this country. So I don't know.
Do you make any distinctions between pharmaceutical companies and device manufacturers, or do you see them as the same?
They're different, but I know much less about the device. I mean, you would think I would know a lot more living here. But in fact, because of, you know, the fact that a large part of my interest is in, you know, other things that don't involve devices, like, you know, like psychiatry, for example, I don't know nearly as much. But it's, you know, it's been a big issue here. I mean, we had a Senate investigation of our chair of spine surgery for, you know, $1.2 million from Medtronic. And I have the sense that that's not going away.
How about the journals? The journals, aren't they peer-reviewed?
Yeah. The journal editors have largely been some of the most outspoken critics of, ex-journal editors have been like Marcia Angel and Jerry Kasirer and Richard Smith from the BMJ, Richard Horton at The Lancet have been, you know, extremely critical of the pharmaceutical industry. And it's been journal editors, I think the journal editors have been very worked up about the issue of ghostwriting. Like, you know, because, I mean, the thing about the ghostwritten articles is that, you know, it's not that they're appearing in second-rate journals. I mean, they're appearing in the very best journals. You know, you're talking JAMA, the New England Journal of Medicine, all the kind of big subspecialty journals. And, you know, when a journal editor finds out that they have published an article that's been produced by a paid medical writer and, you know, an academic has signed his name to it, they're not happy. That said, they have, well, there are two problems. One, they in general have very little way of recognizing the ghosted articles because they're difficult to pick out. Peer reviewers, you know, it's not something that a peer reviewer is going to be able to see because the whole business revolves around scrubbing any mention of the pharmaceutical company or the medical education company from the article. And, you know, these people are pros. A lot of the medical writers who are ghostwriting these things are people with a lot of medical training. I mean, they're very often PhD scientists who've been doing this stuff for years. So, you know, they're very well-written articles. And they're difficult to, you know, they're difficult to pick out, even if you're trying to pick them out. Now, that said, I do think they could do more. I mean, one of the things that seems frustrating to me is that the journal editors don't really seem interested in any sanctions against academics who have been found out for signing on to ghosted medical articles. You would think it would be fairly easy. You know, say you find out from Vioxx or Avandia or Zyprexa litigation that, you know, this one guy published a ghosted article in your journal and signed his name to it. Couldn't you fairly easily say, all right, you're banned from, you know, from this journal? I mean, that seems like a fairly easy step they could take, but nobody's been willing to do that.
You know, and you talked about the public relations man that they're putting out the clips,
the PRs.
To and providing them, and they're really, you know, stunted with the whatever the sort of drug company or whatever it is, and it's disguised or not. It's not often, you know, introduced for what it is. And actually, in journalism, popular press, as their resources are less and less, and they have fewer journalists actually looking things over, and they have pressure to produce product all the time. I think that there's more that's slipping in.
Yeah. You know, I think you're right. Although it's
like it would be special to the byline would be special to the Pioneer Press, you know.
Right. Although I mean, do you think that print journalism is as easy to dupe in the same way as TV journalism?
Well, I don't think they're duped, but I think they're just in a survival game too.
Right.
Oftentimes. Content.
Yeah.
We, you know, like I'm not saying that any publication or anything, but just that.
Right. Well, the producers of the VNR say, you know, this is just like a press release, except it's video. There's a certain similarity. You can see why that story flies. But, you know, when it's been put together totally for you, it's just basically like blocking and copying from a press release. And, you know, that's really not standard journalism practice, or ought not to be anyway.
Yeah, speaking of media coverage,
you're obviously, you know, you're speaking about this a lot. You published a book about it. But has there been any public, like local, you know, public outrage and public media coverage about this issue specifically? Like, I'm forgetting his name, but the guy who's like an adjunct faculty member at the university. Has there been any local media coverage of that issue?
Yeah, and it's actually been pretty good. I mean, the Strib and the Pioneer Press have both, been pretty vigilant about this. But, you know, the problem is, well, there have been a lot of stories. I mean, it's just a lot of stuff at the University of Minnesota. It seems like for a while there, it was just sort of every month there was a new scandal. And, you know, after a while, it all just starts to look the same to people. You know, it's just yet another University of Minnesota doctor on the pharma payroll. You know, like, okay, I thought I just read about that. Well, you did. But the other thing is that the university's PR strategy seems to be, you know, people will forget about it. And they do forget about it. And so, you know, there's a few days, you know, there'll be a story, there may be a follow-up story, and the response will be, well, you know, either A, we'll look into that, or B, we don't see anything wrong with that. And then it goes away, and then nothing is done. I think, you know, part of the reason that people feel as if, you know, things are actually maybe getting better with all of this stuff is that there's so much publicity about it. But publicity doesn't equal fixing the problem. I mean, that, you know, the Abuzahab stuff, I mean, God, that's like, I don't know, how old is that? You know, how old is that now? 15 years? And it's still not fixed.
Do you see this infiltrating other industries? The food industry has been on the global warming. Yeah. Do you see the same percentages, do you think, with corporate interests and funding?
Yeah, I do, although I don't know enough about them to, you know, to comment intelligently on them. I mean, it's interesting to me that it seems to take like a huge scandal before everybody gets worked up enough to say, all right, you know, we really need to fix this. And I guess I kind of thought that Vioxx was the huge scandal with pharma and that everybody would get worked up about it and that, you know, that would bring some action. But for some reason, it hasn't really. And, I don't really know what it takes. I mean, there are a lot of deaths from Vioxx, and it still didn't.
You know, I used to take Vioxx once in a while way back when it was, and then when they started bringing out information about it. So I remember my doctor saying, I'm not faulting him either, but it reflects people in general. That's the trouble with the government. Here is one good drug that's helped so many people. One person has a heart attack, and I can't prescribe.
Right.
I used to say that all the time. If I bring up Vioxx, go get some Vioxx, he'd say, it's funny.
Good.
You have another book in you. What would it be about? And I have a suggestion for you.
Yeah, I do have it. It's a book that I've been thinking about writing. I published a piece in The New Yorker. I tend to be like a magnet for bad psychiatrists. And when I worked at the University of Otago in New Zealand, our chair of psychiatry went to prison for poisoning his wife. And his son also went to prison for strangling his wife at more or less the same time. And he was a sociopath, and there are a lot of interesting things about him. But, you know, that was such a crazy, complicated story, and I was so close to it because I worked there that I thought it was too short for an article, and maybe I could make that into a book. But I don't know. What's your suggestion for a new book?
The relationship between units of medicine that will change their standard. And I'm going to cite cholesterol. When people were supposedly dying from cholesterol, that's the claim today, which is not really true, that they die from cholesterol. They got a heart attack, which might be. But it seems to me there's a pipeline between the doctors who say, if you're on these drugs, Crestor, Lipitor, et cetera, we're going to prevent a heart attack. And that doesn't go away. And that's been out there for quite a while, but it does not do that. This summer, early summer, I think there was some discussion in the news media about looking at this set of data that was talking about it. And soon after, it's a University of Minnesota professor who had done the original research on cholesterol and its impact on heart disease. If we lowered it, then in fact would reduce heart attacks and deaths. And it just went away. The whole thing just went away. And there seemed to be a little bit of, you know, pharma's got a ton of money coming out of these drugs. A lot of it going, that we're putting in through tax dollars, going right back into the program. But there's this closed loop, it's nice, that is affecting all of us, and it makes it very difficult, in fact, to make change in the medical insurance industry. So I think that one little example, since it's in Minnesota and there's this revered faculty member, I don't remember his name, but he sounded a little skeptical about his data. But he was defending the original data, not necessarily what we have now. And my point is, you can't get the current status to go back and change these standards. And that, we just seem to go forward. I think you've applied that. Until there's a scandal, until there's something really ridiculous about it.
Or a financial interest in doing things the old way.
That would be my... I think a lot of older people, when they've been on these drugs for a while, they are really negatively impacted physically. Pick up symptoms of things like arthritis, which they may never have had clinically, genetically, but now they've got it. And it's not right that the drug company would create another set of products to sell to the people to cure the arthritis.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Well, who is in charge? The doctors or the pharmaceutical, really? I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are telling the doctors what to do. Because, for example, I had a friend with cancer, and I asked the oncologist, why does he need 6 treatments? And she said, well, because the pharmaceutical company said that would be best. We don't know if it's 1, 2, or 6.
Was she in a clinical trial?
No, it was for cancer treatment.
Okay, so that was just the standard recommendation. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's definitely been a power shift in my lifetime. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry has gotten much bigger and more profitable and more powerful. It used to be, I can remember when I was in medical school, it was for an academic to work with the pharmaceutical industry was slightly kind of questionable. It was felt as if you were compromising in some way. When you collaborated with industry, it was something to be a little defensive about. Now it's just the opposite. Working with the pharmaceutical industry is a mark of status. It's how you make your career. It's, you know, it's seen as a kind of honor. And, you know, it's largely because that's where the power is now. I mean, even medical research, which used to be kind of the stronghold of academic health centers, that's been almost completely outsourced. Something like 75% of all clinical trials are now done outside academic health centers now. And, you know, when, you know, power tends to build upon power, the more power you have, the more power you can get. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is such a powerful lobby in Washington. There are all these spin-off industries that are also dependent on it and dependent on its well-being, like the clinical trials industry and the research ethics industry and so on. I think you're right. I mean, it's definitely business that's in charge now.
Could you comment on the safety of college students being paid to test investigational drugs? I have a nephew's son who... The nephew thinks it's perfectly all right because he went on the internet and whoever spoke on the internet said it's okay, safe. Dougie can make $3,000 over Christmas vacation and has made thousands already, but he's taking all these drugs in his system. And I just wondered if you could comment on the safety of that.
You know, I wouldn't do it.
I pay my grandson.
It's sad that he goes on the internet and the father has okayed it because the internet says it's safe.
Well, see, here's the thing. All right, so the thing you have to realize is that mostly the trials that you can get paid for are safety trials. So the whole purpose of the trial is to figure out if the drug is safe or not. So if someone's telling you the drug is safe before the safety trials are done, it's just not true. That said, that used to be the case that those were the main studies that you could get paid for. Now the industry's starting to push the envelope. And so you're seeing trials for already approved medications where they're trying to recruit people with mild illnesses. So if you've got asthma or if you've got anxiety or depression or if you're slightly overweight or maybe diabetes or something like that, you can get paid for a study. If it's a drug that has already been approved, and especially if it's one that's been on the market for a long time, I would feel more comfortable with that. I would still be very cautious. I'll tell you also that, you know, and I don't vouch for this, but in the world of professional guinea pigs, what they say is that the so-called bioequivalent studies are seen as the safest of all. They're also the lowest paying. So bioequivalent studies are, you have a drug, it's been on the market forever, the patent has gone off, and now a generic drug company wants to market a generic version of it. And so they have to show the FDA that their generic version is essentially the same as the regular version. And, you know, so they'll pay people to test those. And the feeling among the guinea pig pros is that those are the safest of all because you're not talking about drugs that are investigational anymore. They're drugs that have been on the market for a while. But, you know, those are also the lower paying studies. A lot of it, I think, is also, when I was talking to them, their sense was they felt a lot safer at particular trial sites that they had experience with and that they felt good about, and where the recruiters they felt were more honest with them. And so they had special, you know, sort of trusted people who they said, you know, she'll tell me, you know, don't enroll in this one. You know, you'll really be making your money with that. Whether or not, I don't think I would rely on that myself, but that's the sense among the guinea pig pros. Another interesting thing I found out about the guinea pig pros, they all hated psychiatric drug trials. I mean, almost all of them would say, I won't do a trial for psychiatric drugs. And whether it's because they felt those were more dangerous or they just didn't want their minds messed with in some way, I'm not sure, but that seemed to be a fairly common thing that I heard. All right, we're done. Thank you. Thanks.